This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Brave by Rose McGowan. This is the author. Author's note. My life has always been one of extremes. Brave, the book, has proven to be no different. While writing this book, I endured being hacked, stalked, spied on, had parts of this manuscript stolen. My life was infiltrated by Israeli spies and harassing lawyers, some of the most formidable on Earth. These evil people hounded me at every turn while I went about resurrecting the ghosts that have made up my time on Earth. I can only say it was extraordinarily stressful, an incredible high-wire act that required great strategy. There was never any other choice. justice would be served. And it was. I am immeasurably proud of having a hand in this cataclysmic global reckoning and the felling of monsters. I truly believe that a win for one of us is a win for all of us. A few years ago, I realized society needed to be primed to hear the story. So I set about taking my voice of dissent public. I decided to openly fight the machine, the manufacturers of myth, the gaslighters themselves, the sacred men of Hollywood. For far too long, they'd been on top and able to get away with criminal behavior. I wanted to make it impossible to look away. And then the U.S. election happened, making sexism far harder to deny. It paved the way for obvious truth to be revealed to those who'd for so long turned a blind eye. In early 2017, I'd been working on Brave for a few months when I made contact with two investigative reporters. It was time. The story took many twists and turns as it all unfolded, and I'm proud to have had a hand in starting the worldwide conversation. Since I and so many Brave survivors have come forward, titans of every industry have toppled. We survivors have gained our power. We survivors are using our voices in record numbers. We cannot let up, and as hard as it is, we must continue to get even louder, to push even harder. We all count. We all matter. Here's to freedom. Yours and mine. Now go breathe fire. Preface. Did you break up with someone? At first, the question made me angry. I thought it sexist, stereotypical, disheartening. There was no death of a relationship that made me so in need of freedom that I'd alter myself. The more the breakup question was asked, the more it made me think about my motives. I realized I had broken up with someone. I broke up with you. The collective you. The societal you. I broke up with the Hollywood ideal, the one that I had a part in playing. The ideal version of woman that is sold to you by every actress in every hair commercial telling you, this is the secret to being beguiling, the secret to getting a man to want you. Long, glossy, Kardashian-esque hair that says, fuck me, big boy. As if that's all we are and all we can be. Hair. Hair is what I broke up with. And it was a breakup that was years in the making. It took a lot to wake me from my brainwashed slumber. My long hair had always made me uncomfortable. It made men look at me while the real me disappeared. I would use it to cover my face, to check out, to sleep. And sleep I did. The real Rose slept while the fake Rose lived a bizarre alternate life playing the part of someone who played parts. Most of my life I had short hair. I preferred it that way. The classic film stars and punk women I most admired had short hair. I liked very much being an individual. I liked looking neither female nor male, but hovering somewhere in between. The two periods of time when I had long hair were the hardest in my life, the times I was most lost from myself. My teen years when I suffered from a raging eating disorder, and later, when I suffered from a mental disorder called Hollywood. The Hollywood disorder lasted a much longer time, but both had to do with being absent from self. Both times were driven by society's number one propaganda machine, Hollywood. I was told I had to have long hair, otherwise the men doing the hiring in Hollywood wouldn't want to fuck me. And if they didn't want to fuck me, they wouldn't hire me. I was told this by my female agent, which is tragic on many levels. So, so evil. And so, so sad. Evil because I took the information from an older woman who was the mouthpiece for what Hollywood wants. Sad because she was right. This message gets filtered down to all women and girls telling us to have long hair so we too can be sexy. But I got the direct message, like a hotline phone call straight from what the man wants. Well, fuck Hollywood. Fuck the messaging. Fuck the propaganda. Fuck the stereotypes. If you're a Jennifer Lawrence, America's Sweetheart type, you have simple blonde hair. If you're the Vixen, it is long, dark, and big. Those are the rules. Do not deviate. My long hair was beautiful, like beauty pageant contestant hair. My hairdressers were gay males, and I was their Barbie come to life. At least that's what they told me. I didn't think I looked like Barbie. I thought I looked more like a blow-up sex doll, the kind with the hole for the mouth. I'd been turned into the ultimate fantasy fuck toy by the Hollywood machine. All the men and women hired to make me look like said fantasy fuck toy did a good job. But I was dying on the inside and embarrassed by what I looked like on the outside. But I didn't know how to change what was wrong when there were so many levels of wrong in my life. I meet so many women and girls who tell me their hair is a security blanket and what they hide behind. I find this not only relatable, but heartbreaking. Of course you should have long hair if you feel like having long hair. But examine your motives. What part does society play in telling you how you should look? What part does media play in showing you what you should be? And if you are hiding behind your hair, why do you want to live a life in hiding, and what are you hiding from? When I shaved my head, it was a battle cry. But more than that, it gave me an answer to the question I so hated. Did I break up with someone? Yes. I broke up with the world. You can too. My name is Rose McGowan, and I am brave. Introduction. There once was a famous actress named Frances Farmer. She hated everything about her artificial life. She wanted to be free. Frances tried to escape fame and the toxicity of Hollywood's male-dominated world, but the studio had her captured. They took Frances to a mental institution. They locked her up. There was nothing wrong with her mind. She just didn't want to be famous. She screamed, begging for her life. Instead, they took it. They laid her down, restrained her, and shocked her mind with electricity. Shock, shock, shock. Over and over. The male powers that be in Hollywood wanted Frances to be a submissive, good little girl, and remain so. What they left of her was an empty shell, a husk of a woman. Frances was never Frances again. And all because she didn't want to be sold as entertainment. Very few sex symbols escape Hollywood with their minds intact, if they manage to stay alive at all. The streets of Hollywood are paved over the bodies of the vulnerable, the fucked with, the lied to, and the hurt. I know. I was almost one of them. You may think that what happens in Hollywood doesn't affect you. You're wrong. My darlings, who do you think is curating your reality? Who is showing you who and what you want to be? I want to have a frank conversation about an inner sickness that I see few, if any, addressing how and why Hollywood creates a fucked up mirror for you to look in. How you are seeing yourself through your own eyes, but perhaps not your own mind. Hollywood affects your life in ways you may not even be aware of. In my past of being sold as a product, I have been part of massaging your brain. I wiggled into your mind professionally. I was the cigarette the advertisers told you you needed. I've also been on the other side of the looking glass, watching you, studying you, impersonating you. All of us in Hollywood, media, and advertising do. And you know what? We are really good at it. We have had it drilled into us how best to be marketed to you, how best to be sold to you, how to implant what we want into your brain, into your thoughts, into your wallet. And it works. You're sold a fake reality, all for the rock-bottom price of $14. The men who thought they own me think that they own you. They are the latest in a long line of myth peddlers. From the men behind the Bible to these modern-day content creators. They're mostly self-aggrandizing, egomaniacal abusers of power, and they've never been more dangerous. Few in Hollywood, and no actress that I can recall has gone rogue. Hollywood operates like the mafia when it comes to protecting its own, especially if your own is a rich white male. Yes, I said it, but here's the thing, it's true. I didn't make it so, it just is. In other news, the sky is blue. By telling some of my story, I aim to shine a light. For those who think Hollywood is a silly joke, it's not. It's a deadly serious business and one that keeps its winnings. You may think it's as simple as forking over hard-earned cash for a night out at the movies or paying a cable bill to be entertained. I'm here to tell you the price you're paying is much higher than you know. You're paying with your mind, your behavior, and your patterns, things that should have no price tag. In our as-seen-on-TV society, the simple fact is that what you have watched and consumed from birth has formed you and continues to form you. Even those who've opted out of its false reality have to stay vigilant to remain free from the lies and from the messages that do far more harm than they should because they are insidious and they are everywhere. My life, as you will read, has taken me from one dangerous cult to another, one of the biggest cults of all, Hollywood. I say biggest because short of a nuclear bomb, Hollywood has the farthest reach. Brave is the story of how I fought my way out of these cults and reclaimed my life. I want to help you do the same. You can say no more. You can say yes to a freer you. You can be free of the trap that's been set for you, and believe me, it has been set. I am writing this book because I want to have a real conversation with the public, and most especially you. I am honored that my words will enter your consciousness and conscience, that my thoughts will rest in your mind. I take that responsibility seriously. Call what I'm doing a public service, and you'd be correct. It is. Hollywood is a dirty town up to some dirty tricks. This is not a tell-all. This is a tell-it-how-it-is. Part 1. Child of God. Here's the thing about cults. I see them everywhere. If you're deep into the Kardashians, you're in a cult. If you watch your favorite TV show and go online and you're in chat rooms with everybody else who's obsessed with that show and you're breaking it down episode by episode, you're in a cult. If you're binging, scrolling, absorbing from one news source more than any other, especially if it happens to be fair and balanced, you are in a cult. You're living your life through other people. If you blindly vote for so-and-so, you're in a cult. If you're deep into your country's propaganda machine, you're in a cult. Look around you and see where the cults are, because they are everywhere. Anywhere there is group thought and group mentality, you're in a cult, you're in a cult, you're in a cult. The first step to deprogramming yourself from a cult is realizing you are in a cult. I would know, I escaped from two of the most iconic cults of all time. For those who knew me as an actress, I must inform you that I was never that person. I was playing the part of someone who played parts. I was trapped by rigid societal ideals and gender expectations placed on me by people who shouldn't have been allowed near me or you. I got such a deep mind-fucking. I rejected brainwashing early on in life, but later, Hollywood's cult of thought actually got me. My life altered irrevocably the day I turned into a pixel, beamed up to an orbiting satellite and beamed back down, blasted across living rooms, bedrooms, lives. My job was to take you away from your struggles for a while, to make you feel empathy, to make you feel it all. I took my job seriously. But, like in most cults, because I was a woman, I was considered to be an owned object. I was sold for the pleasure of the public. Deeply programmed men and women made money selling my breasts, my skin, my hair, my emotions, my health, my being. I was not taken seriously, nor was I respected. Not by most of society, and certainly not by the Hollywood cult with its massively industrialized Madonna horror complex. Imagine if your value to the company you work for was measured by how much semen you could extract from anonymous masses of men. 'Cause you know, if strange men masturbate to your movies, you must be of some value. Sounds like a sex worker, right? Yeah, you're not too far off. Imagine that every word to come out of your mouth for nearly 17 years, day after day, month after month, angle after angle, take after take, was something an all too narrow-minded male wrote for you to say. It's meta, and it's deeply abnormal. It took me a long time to figure out that I was in another cult because I was too busy being other people, not myself. By telling the story of my life, I am reclaiming it. But let's start at the beginning, shall we? In a stone barn, in the tiny Italian countryside town of Certaldo, delivered by a blind midwife, as the story goes, I came into the world. There's an American saying, "Shut that door, were you born in a barn?" I guess I never have to shut doors if I don't want to. I have that prerogative. I suppose sometimes you're just earmarked for weirdness from birth, and I think I'm one of those. The barn was on the property of the Duke of Zoagli, known as Duke Emanuele, who, upon joining the Children of God, donated his estate and land to Children of God. His sister Rosa Ariana lived on the property, but loathed all the Children of God members living there. My parents named me after her, Rosa Ariana, I think to make her like them. Didn't work. It was incredibly beautiful there in the rolling hills outside Florence. The dark green cypresses and silvery green olive trees. Vineyards and orchards, those enormous old terracotta jars holding red geranium flowers. I suppose if you have to be in a cult, it was as good a place as any. Nah, it was better, and even at a young age, I saw the beauty and I knew it was wildly extraordinary. I connected to its nature as an escape from what I was born into. As a result, I've always been drawn to shapes, colors, and light patterns, and the Italian countryside has haunted me my whole life, in a good way. From my earliest memories, I recall hearing a lot about a terrifying old man named Moses David Berg, our fearless leader in the Children of God. He would send his directives out in cartoon pamphlets called Mo Letters. Whatever Moses David wrote, that's what was done. Each time there was a new letter, it would be as if the ruler of the universe had spoken. Kind of like the head of a studio in Hollywood. And I guess as a self-appointed prophet he was, Moses David turned out to be the king of creeps. But the others didn't know that yet. Some would never know. I remember a lot of hairy legs, men's and women's, like in the cartoons where you only see the adult's legs because that's your perspective as a child. I remember a lot of singing, praying, clapping, and snapping. Yes, snapping. I was told I had to sit on the floor all day and learn how to snap my fingers, otherwise God wouldn't teach me to drive when I was 16. I didn't understand anything about 16 and driving, but even then I could tell finger snapping as the key to doing anything was patently absurd. One night, a ghostly-looking woman in a white robe came into the room I was in. She was like a shadow holding a candle. There was no electricity. It was storming outside, and I remember the wooden shutter slapping against the old glass window. I had been worried the window was going to break, but I was now distracted by the woman in white who sat by my feet. The wind was whistling through the cracks in the stone, and I was having trouble hearing her. The wind stopped and she looked straight into me and said, "Have you let God into your heart?" I sat up, looked at her, considered carefully, and shook my head no. The woman pinches my foot and twists my skin. I am not going to cry because I know that's what she wants. For this refusal, there was punishment. Corporal punishment, slaps and spankings because spare the rod, spoil the child. She twists harder. I bite the inside of my lip so I don't cry. I stare back, silently defiant. The woman says it again, this time in German. Hast du Gott in dein Herz gelassen? I think about it and say, no, not today. Try tomorrow. She slaps me across the face, hard. Even at that tender age, I reasoned that if I invited him into my heart, it would be their God I was letting inside. It would no longer be my God, whom I was very protective of. And their God was cruel. What they were preaching made no sense to me, their actions not squaring with their words. That was not a reality I wanted to exist in. Later, my younger sister Daisy urged me to just say yes, that it would go easier for me. But I kept taking the punishment instead. I was, as my name foretold, quite thorny. Whereas my sister was a little golden-haired, sweet child, I would stare at her and wonder how she got that way and how she couldn't see what was going on. It was a strange sensation growing up behind these walls and being told I did not belong to the outside world, but I also knew I didn't belong to the world within. When that woman or another woman or another man, all strangers, returned the next night and the night after, I always had the same response. No, no, I have not let God into my heart. Slap. One night I could hear the woman's German whispers and her feet doing a quiet kind of stomp on the floor. I knew I was going to get hurt again. No. Slap. When she was gone, I saw that she left her Bible on my sleep mat. All the kids slept on flimsy orange or blue plastic mats. I hid her Bible behind a cabinet. Each day I'd tear out a new page, put a small piece in my mouth, work it around, add more and spit it out, turning it into little mush blobs. Then I would take the Bible blobs and form them into tiny animals. I hid them behind the cabinet and would visit them now and then when I could steal a moment. They were my toys, one part saliva, one part Jesus. I figured if I literally ingested their God, maybe I could answer, yes, I have let him in. Maybe they'd stop punishing me. The smacks, the pushes, enforced the message that you were not allowed to be imperfect. When I was about 4, I had a wart on my thumb. I was toddling down this long hallway when one of the doors opened. I remember the shaft of light and all the dust motes dancing. A man with shaggy blonde hair picked me up, looked at my hand and said, "Perfection in all things." He held up a razor blade and sliced my hand with one swipe, winking at me as he sat me back down. "Perfection in all things," he said again before shutting the door and leaving me in the hallway. I didn't cry. I was too stunned. Blood ran over my hand and I made a dripping mess of the hallway. The blood coursed over my fingers, the red strangely pretty. Like my hand, I was numb. I knew not to react because, one, that was something they wanted from me, and two, I thought maybe there was something to this perfection thing. I walked on. The hallway assault is what started a narrative that fucked with my head for years, that of perfection as self-protection. I told myself if I were just perfect enough, I'd be okay. If I were just perfect enough, I'd be left alone, and no one would want to hurt me. From then on, I willed myself to be as perfect as possible because I didn't know what would happen to me if I wasn't. I was terrified of having an aberration in any way. I was sure that having any kind of flaw would spell doom. But first, I had to figure out what all my flaws were. And so began a habit of being extremely hard on myself, seeing myself from the outside in. I started to look at my hands and feet daily to make sure I didn't have any bumps growing. There were no mirrors that I can remember in the cult. When I would later arrive in a culture that was so externally focused, America, and then Hollywood, this caused a tear in the fabric of my being. The funny thing was that in almost direct opposition to the message the cult sent us about perfection, My father was preaching to me and my siblings that we were not under any circumstances to develop an ego. Our focus was to be on our internal development, the development of our souls and our intellects. I suppose we are supposed to be perfect physically, but remain humble in the face of our perfection. I was never really sure. All I knew was that I was not supposed to think good thoughts about myself, that God would punish me for thinking that I was awesome. Never once growing up was I told that I was intelligent, smart, or beautiful. I don't know what that feels like. I was never told I could do anything I wanted if I set my mind to it. I was told I was worth nothing in the eyes of God. I was told I was going to be a whore. I was told I was dirty. And the thing is, I knew they were wrong. But the word still stung. From an early age, I remember being furious that nobody would listen to me just because I was a child. It was so unfair. I hated being little and powerless. I would look at the people and the children of God and think, but all these things you're all talking about, I could solve them in two easy steps if you adults would just listen to what I'm saying. But nobody would listen to me because I was a girl. That set a real pattern for my life. I was a born dissenter, not for the sake of being contrary, but because if you could see things for what they were, identify the source of a problem and the solution, why wouldn't you want to fix it? But nobody would listen to me. They just sat me at the little kid's table. Not unlike later in Hollywood. Just a girl, after all. My only friends during my time in Children of God were my older brother, Nat, my pet lamb, Agnello, and an old gray-haired farmer named Stinky Fernando. Stinky Fernando was deeply suspicious of bathing. You could almost chew his smell. It was so thick. I had to breathe through my mouth whenever he was around. One day, I heard Stinky Fernando screaming. My father and some of the other members took him by his arms and ankles and threw him in a river. Much to Stinky Fernando's surprise, his skin did not melt off. Stinky Fernando took Nat and me into an old barn and showed us faded Playboy magazines while feeding us stale Kit Kats. A real treat. I wondered about the women in the magazines. They didn't have hairy legs. It was confusing. I loved the rancid Kit Kats, though. I loved candy way more than I loved their god. I bottle-fed my friend, the little lamb in yellow, and helped take care of her. My first pet. One night, at the long dinner table, I took a bite of food, and a thin woman with a mean face and center-parted hair started to laugh. Others joined in, and soon everyone was laughing. I didn't understand what was funny until they told me it was Agnello being served. And so I realized my pet was being fed to me for dinner. I sat stunned while everyone at the long table laughed. I pushed my tears down and felt a coldness wall off my heart towards these people, something crystallizing into a stone of pure hatred as I looked at their monster faces. They had a particularly cruel streak, and they liked to destabilize the younger members. These were lovers of Christ, right? To this day, I've never eaten lamb again. I started to become angry. Angry at the injustices that were adding up. Angry at the rules that seemed and were so arbitrary. I decided the best course of action was to light it up. And so one day my older brother decided to light a stable on fire. He was mad too. I for sure wanted to be there for that, so I ran after him to help. We were in the barn when my brother pulled out a book of matches. He started lighting them and flicking them at the hay on the stone floor. Whoosh! The fire leaped up the side of the walls and onto the ceiling. The roof was thatched hay and started popping above us. I tried stamping out the flaming pieces with my feet, but I was too little and it was too late. I stamped and stamped, but I couldn't put them out. If I had known how to say fuck, I am sure I would have. The roof crackled more and it was getting very hot. I knew we were in big trouble if we went outside and were caught by the adults, but everything was on fire. We chose to run. This is the part where I'm supposed to tell you some hideous story of punishment for lighting it up, but I really can't remember. I do remember the terror of being found out. It made me feel like my skin was about to fall off with fear. The movie scene of this would be: a sturdy blonde boy and an elfin girl are hiding from their father. Suddenly, four hands grab them by the shirt collars, dragging them off. Turning down a path in a maze, the children are paraded past a gauntlet of leering cult members. The members drag the children to the Judge of All. The Judge of All is on a throne made of soft wood. There are young nude women, heavy-breasted and round-bottomed, on their knees, gazing up adoringly and reverentially at the dynamically dangerous leader. The leader tilts his head back, eyes shut. He's being worshipped. He's in heaven on earth. The women work oils and lotions into the leader's skin, their hands using a feathering touch as they go, chanting with intention. The leader, the Judge of All, opens his eyes and points at the boy and girl. The shaming begins. Sounds like a Hollywood film, right? Maybe it's not too far off. In fact, my life as a performer began there in the cult. We were made to go out in groups to sing at local orphanages and hospitals or on the streets to perform. Singing Jesus songs on the streets of Rome with a hat in front of me, street busking. After the coins would stack up in the hat, a hand would come over my shoulder and take all the coins I'd earned. They let me carry the empty hat. Gee, thanks. It was my work that was bringing the money in, and I was pissed at the injustice of having to give it up. I'd see regular families with the kids walking around with gelatos and candy, and I'd wonder about their lives at home. Did they have a bed? We had plastic mats and I got cold at night. The girls wore pretty dresses. I had faded brown overalls and Jesus sandals. My hands and feet would get dirty and I'd try to hide them when other cleaner children looked at me. For hours we would stand and sing those damn songs under the hot sun and the rain. It didn't matter. I was 5 or so. My little legs would get so sore from standing, but I knew I couldn't sit or there'd be trouble. We had to return with money or else there'd be sanctions and punishments against our family. I could feel the stress of the adult members as the systemites, that's what they called people outside the cult, turned away and ignored us and the pamphlets we were selling. Little incoming money equals not much food. Not surprisingly, there was often hunger. Our food was rationed. If we returned with not enough money, the rationed food was given to another family as punishment. If potential new members or press were coming to visit, they'd put us kids on a white rice, milk, and sugar diet to fatten us up. We'd stuff ourselves with it until we gagged, but I loved it because at least there was something to keep me full, plus sugar, which I loved. Sometimes the local press would be invited to come and cover our good deeds. To see what great work we're doing in the Children of God community, join us. See, we're not a bunch of freaky hippies. What kind of freak could sing a Jesus song this well? I was sent to entertain sick children in hospitals. I remember thinking, kid, if this is your last day on earth, I am really sorry that we're forcing you to listen to little me singing about Jesus. I don't want to be here either. I apologize. But even though it was awkward performing in hospitals, and this may sound weird, I always knew I was going to be famous. Even before I understood what fame was, it was kind of a foregone conclusion. I don't know how to explain it. At some point in my childhood, I remember being taken to see a film. It had a great impact on me. I don't know what it was called. It was Italian. The lead actress had short raven hair and was a nurse. She wore a crisp white uniform and a little white hat. She was in a phone booth, crying and screaming at her married doctor lover who was throwing her aside. She took the back of her hand and smeared her lipstick across her face. She ripped her shirt open, popping its buttons. Her chest exposed, she took lipstick out of her purse and drew all over her breasts like a wild woman. I was captivated. It was fabulous. I wanted her lipstick and her hair. I finally got to see some glamour in my young life, and I knew it was for me. My feelings of being in the wrong life intensified. At some point, my father found a Brownie, a vintage camera, so the few photos that exist from my childhood look like they're super old and are largely black and white. I watched my father as he captured objects and people with the camera. Then I got to play with it myself. I learned to see things through a frame. Looking through that crappy lens, I felt as if I could see more, and that everything I looked at told a story. Soon I was nearly always outside of myself, watching and filming and documenting everything that was going on, taking note of everything. Smells, sounds, tastes, situations, people. Only now can I see that this was early disassociation to deal with trauma. Looking through a lens has been a coping mechanism I have employed throughout my life. It had a silver lining, my falling in love with photography and cameras. But more than that, it gave me a way of putting something between me and the world, and a different way of looking at it. Every detail as seen through a lens. Because it's not really happening if I'm once removed, right? I also used books as an escape. Words were my solace and my saviors when I was small, and have remained so to this day. Words, different lives, different centuries. That was how I survived. Books also furthered my training for being an actor because I took on the persona of whichever character I was reading. It could be a serf, it could be a queen. I would mimic the posture, everything about that character while I was reading his or her story. When I finished a book, I went into mourning for that character because it was a death. I took books very seriously, but not the Children of God books. I could not understand how anyone could believe them. Those Mo letters were just so, well, stupid. It's so hard to understand how so many have fallen for it. Meanwhile, the beliefs and practices of Children of God started getting more and more dangerous. Moses David, our leader, made the young women members do this thing called flirty fishing. He sent them out, and these were little more than girls, really, to seduce men at bars or cafes. The men would wake up in the cult. Moses David christened the girls Hookers for Jesus. Hookers for Jesus? Fuck you, Moses David, you piece of shit. Fuck you for all the pain you caused. At the end of the day, it was all about male dominance and using sex as a weapon for mind control. Beautiful women were major targets, not unlike what I would later see in Hollywood. And like in Hollywood, there were women who helped Moses David do bad things to others. The cult was a highly sexualized environment, run by men to benefit men. My father loved it, I could tell. I remember standing in a corner, watching my father preach as he sat on a throne-like rattan chair. Women, girls, were on their knees staring up at him with dreamy expressions. Women literally worshipped at his feet. I remember looking at the women on their knees, and my father on his throne. I'll never be like those women, I thought. Never. It grossed me out. Looking back, it was the time of my father's life when he was at his most radiant. Abuse of power was inevitable, and he certainly abused his position. One day my father said to my very young mother, Saffron, my mother's name in the cult, I want to be married to this other woman as well. Well, hell, that must have sucked. There have been lots of times I have wanted to go back in time and kick my father's ass, this being one of them. My poor mother's own mom, Sharon, had just died tragically. My mother's dad was gone, too. She was alone in a cult in another country with a bunch of kids she was told to have, and now this? It must have been crushing. She had no choice, and he took another wife. That's how my four youngest siblings, two full and two half, are so close in age. Children of God next started advocating child-adult sex as a way to live the law of love, which is just beyond disgusting and criminal. I saw an 11-year-old girl being forced to sit next to a naked man with his floppy dick on his leg. They made her sit between his legs so he could massage her back. I saw her tears. Even then, I knew none of it was normal, whatever normal was. I don't think there really is such a thing as normal, but I knew that this was something deeply wrong, something to be avoided at all costs. I feel bad for that small child I was, who who from age 3 or 4 already knew so much about surviving. I didn't know what it was like to feel safe. In its place, there was stress, and underneath it all, a deep undercurrent of fear running through the commune. From a very early age, I realized kids were very far down the list on things to care about, which is lame when you're the child on the bottom of that long list. An unfortunate necessity in this environment was being able to immediately pick up on danger. I excelled at it. One of my survival skills was, upon entering a room, to locate a weapon. I would do an immediate scan of the area to see what I could use to cause someone else the most damage and defend myself against attack. My quick mind and rapid thought processes have been my lifelong savior as much as my fight. I've always gone by the seat of my pants, and my intuition is damn good. It's too bad I didn't apply the same skills to Hollywood. It would have saved me a lot of heartache. It could have saved me from unspeakable trauma. In any case, my outwit and outlast mentality served me well as a child. Thankfully, I was just young enough to escape getting molested, or maybe my penchant for always having very short hair and wearing my brother's hand-me-downs helped save me. They thought I was a boy most of the time. Although the boys certainly got nailed, too. Fuck, maybe I was just too much of a troublemaker. It would only have been a matter of time. But luckily for us, my father drew the line at pedophilia, and he made secret plans to leave. We couldn't just announce we were leaving and walk away, though. When the cult got wind of certain members wanting to leave, one of their children might disappear, or some family would get severe punishment meted out to them as a way of teaching the others. And so one night my father told us there was a man named Beppo, and he was after us with a hammer. There was a car waiting for us. We got shoved in and go, go, go. First, we fled to a place called Mugnano, a small town in the Tuscany region of Italy. We lived in a centuries-old stone house where we boiled water and bathed in a round, rusted metal tub. We were scraggly kids wearing hippie hand-me-downs. I was used to having many kids around me, so it was strange to share a room with only 4 other children, to be suddenly with so few people, even if they were my actual family instead of the family. My father had left the Children of God physically, if not mentally, taking his other wife, Esther. As for my mother, all I know is that she was left behind. There were so many women in the cult that I didn't have a firm grasp on my mother as an individual. It was just one more level of destabilization and what would be a pattern for me in my life. Now that we were in this small medieval town, I was sent to my first public school. It was very confusing. In the cult, we had worn whatever fit from the pile of donated and hand-me-down clothes, and I mostly wore my brother's clothes. Now I was assigned to wear a pink button-down smock. I preferred the blue smock and asked why I couldn't wear that instead. I asked the teacher about this logic, and she told me because I was a girl, I had to wear pink. Only the boys wore the blue. I thought it was some of the dumbest shit I had ever heard. I was furious that I was now different from my brother for an arbitrary reason. I didn't understand why I now had to wear pink. I still don't. We had a neighbor lady named Antonella who knitted me yellow wool underpants, which are just as uncomfortable as they sound. They were bulky and lumpy and needed to be tied so they stayed up. I was and am wildly allergic to wool. They itched so much on my way to my first day of systemite school that I ditched them and left them behind a bush. I walked out onto the play area on my first school break. It was stressful for me because I didn't know what kids did in regular school. I didn't know what the bells meant or what the rules were. That day, the girls on the playground were doing the Italian version of Ring Around the Rosie. Amore, tesoro, salsiccia pomodoro. After saying pomodoro, the little girls would fall on their backs and kick their feet up in the air. I saw a girl approaching to invite me to play. I thought about my lack of underwear and stiffened, pulling my stupid pink smock down farther. The girl came closer and asked me to join the others. I went mute. I shook my head vigorously side to side, standing rigidly against the wall of the schoolyard. I pulled my smock down farther in case she had any idea to drag me out to play. The girl looked at me like I was crazy. I was still mute. It was my first interaction with a non-cult child, and I didn't know how to talk to her. So I just stayed mute. I was immediately shunned by her and the other girls and labeled a snob. Sigh, it set the tone for the rest of my patchy scholastic career and really, my later life. They knew I was different. I knew I was different. Not better than, not worse than, just different. It wasn't a feeling I had, it was just a fact. I didn't integrate well. I didn't relate to children at all. Theirs was a language I didn't and couldn't speak. They had concerns in life to which I couldn't relate. My problems were about surviving. When you have really big, dark things happen to you, it takes a lot more to care about things. It felt like I was about 8,000 years old in a small person's body, essentially an alien among those who understood traditional societal constructs. On the way to and from the village school, I buried insects. I had a knack for seeing insects in peril. I would arrive at school puffy-eyed from shedding tears at my self-made bug funerals. I'm sure I was unnerving as a child because of my intensity. I know I was because I was basically the same as I am now, and I tend to unnerve people to this day. I saw past everything. All the spiderwebs that people often hide behind so they can tell themselves a story about themselves. It made my father in particular very uncomfortable. Like I said, he may have left the children of God, but the need to be a demigod preacher never left him. And suddenly he was a cult leader without a flock. He expected the women and children around him to worship him, and I never did. To have somebody around who's staring at you and puncturing through the falsehoods you've established to live your life must have been unsettling. Thus, in an ironic twist after all he'd put me through, my father lectured me on how essential it was for me to be more childlike.